What do you expect from God? Bring that to your mind. And then ask yourself, whatever that is, why do you expect that from God? Whatever comes to your mind when you think of God is massively important. A.W. Tozer, a theologian, wrote this some decades ago. It still rings true that whatever comes to your mind when you think about God is the most important thing about you. Creatures can't just think anything about their creator. Whatever you think of God is either true, it's in accord with reality, or it's false. It's not real. And your expectations of God are either right or they are wrong. Now, you do know this on a very personal level. You and I have certain expectations of certain people. Well, how much more God? Expectations of someone else are always based on who you know them to be or who you know them not to be. So it's why you can say about someone when something happens, that was out of character for them. You build trust with someone. You come to rely on their character. All of our lives are built in different ways on expectations of others, expectations of the world. How does God set expectations? Well, he didn't drop a book from heaven with facts about himself. He entered into a covenant relationship with a very real people. And he began to show them his ways and what he's like. And it was very surprising. That's what was happening in the wilderness, in the Exodus. The Lord was slowly setting the expectations of his people so that they would learn what it means to live under his life-giving rule, not under the life-taking rule of Pharaoh. So this morning, my prayer and hope is that from our text, your expectations of God will be set or reset rightly. We're going to be in Exodus 17 through 18. Exodus 17 through 18, if you're new to the Bible, it's the second book of the Bible, and it's the story of God exiting, bringing his people out of Egypt. And right now, they're in the wilderness, going to the land God has promised them. Here's the main point of these two chapters. The Lord is your sure hope and provider. The Lord is your sure hope and provider who gives more than you could expect or deserve, who gives more than you could ever expect or deserve. As we work through these two chapters, I want you to notice in every section, there's a problem and the Lord gives a provision. So let's begin first in chapter 17, just the first seven verses, seeing again this scene dominated by testing and thirst. Testing and thirst. Let's read the first seven verses of chapter 17. All the congregation of the people of Israel moved on from the wilderness of Sin by stages, according to the commandment of the Lord, and camped at Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore, the people quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." And Moses said to them, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?" But the people thirsted there for water. And the people grumbled against Moses and said, why did you bring us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? So Moses cried to the Lord, what shall I do with this people? They are almost ready to stone me. And the Lord said to Moses, pass on before the people, taking with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water shall come out of it, and the people will drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel, and he called the name of the place Massah and Meribah, because of the quarreling of the people of Israel, and because they tested the Lord by saying, is the Lord among us or not? Here's a people who have been fed manna, bread from heaven, and they find themselves again with a water problem. But the text is clear that their circumstances are not random or arbitrary. They are where they are according to the commandment of the Lord. Always expect that the Lord is never arbitrary in your life. He's always acting with purpose. Even here, as his people, verse 2, grumble and quarrel with Moses. So notice here, things intensify. Last chapter, last week, there was a water source, but it was bitter. But at least there was a water source. Here at Rephidim, there is no water, none. But I think more importantly, we saw last week in chapter 16, that there the Lord was testing his people. But here, the people are testing the Lord. In their wisdom, they decided to put their covenant Lord on trial. And it's so bad that Moses, who's clearly at the end of himself, cries out to the Lord, verse 4, that they are almost ready to stone me. They think so poorly of Moses, of his character, that they accuse him of wanting to kill them. And so they wanted to kill him by stoning. Now, think about the seriousness of this moment. They wanted to kill Moses. How many times would this people, the people the Lord has bound himself to, have been totally ruined apart from the intervention of the Lord, apart from Moses interceding for them, especially now when they've threatened to kill him? And then ask yourself, what would you expect the Lord, who through no deserving of their own, but by his power and purpose, rescued this people, what would you expect the Lord to do? Well, he tells them, verse 5, he tells Moses, go ahead of this people. He says, take the elders, take the staff. Now, the staff has been important in Exodus. This shepherd's crook is what Moses used to strike the Nile. And here he goes to the rock Horeb. So the rock is most likely more than just a boulder. It's very most probably the outcropping of a mountain range. And Horeb is the mountain of God. It's another name for Mount Sinai. And if you are thinking about Exodus as we've been through it, we've been here before. This is where God first appeared to Moses at the bush in Exodus 3. Here God called Moses to go back to the Pharaoh, bring the people out of Egypt, and it was there that Moses resisted the Lord in every way that he possibly could. And it was here that the Lord revealed his name, Yahweh, to Moses. In response to Moses' weakness and his unbelief, the Lord promised Moses, I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. This is that mountain. And here is Moses now ahead of the people, back at the mountain, and unexpectedly, he's here with this whole multitude of people behind him, ready to stone him, but the Lord's presence is protecting him. How do we know that? Well, the Lord says it in verse 6. I will stand before you on the rock at Horeb. This must have been quite the moment. I think more than likely it was in the cloud, the Lord's presence protecting Moses from the people. Remember back in chapter 14 that the cloud protected the host of Israel from the Egyptians. And now in chapter 17, the cloud protects this man, Moses, from a multitude of his own people, from the host of Israel. So just notice that we should never think that the presence of the Lord should ever cause us not to expect suffering. But you should expect that the Lord will always give you everything you need in the midst of suffering. Here, by his presence, the Lord protects Moses. So in writing this, Moses was able to look back, see the presence of the Lord with him in ways that even in the midst of that moment, he might not have fully appreciated. The Lord, Moses sees, has been with him. And the Lord who protects Moses from this people who want to kill him upends expectations by providing everything needed for this thirsty people. Moses strikes not the people, but the rock with his staff. Water comes out, the people drink. So to God's people who are testing him, he responds by satisfying their thirst with water. Water ex nihilo, out of nothing. There is no man-made pagan deity that would respond to this kind of people in this way. I take it that the Lord saying he would stand there on the rock, and that in striking the rock, Moses was in essence striking the Lord. So here is very surprising, unexpected character and ways of the Lord. The rebellion and sin of this people, even to the point of testing God and killing Moses, does not stop the Lord from satisfying their thirst with the blessing of water. The Lord provides better than they deserve. Honestly, what God would act like this? Who would make up a God this good? I don't think there would be anyone. This goes against human expectations. Here's a God who will not go back on his promises. He's not forsaking Moses. He's not forsaking the sinful people. Why? For his name's sake. He staked his glory to this people. Here is the Lord who rescues and sustains sinful people, not because of who they are, but because of who he is. He will not quit. And what will it take for the Lord's people to believe, to expect their covenant Lord who's redeemed them, that he has better purposes and plans for them than they would ever even have for themselves? To believe, to expect him to be fundamentally good in a way they can't fathom. To believe that our God is better than we can fathom or expect. Well, what would it take for you to expect that and to believe that? Here is the Lord who gives satisfying water to a people who want to kill his man, the man he's raised up to save them. And this is a moment that will repeat itself. This is a moment that will intensify in the scriptures. Last week we saw in John 6, Jesus said, I am the bread from heaven. In John 7, he is the water that satisfies thirsty people. If you were to read John 7, you would see that it begins in this way. The Jews were seeking to kill Jesus, the Lord's man, the man that God raised up to save his people. And Jesus, as he's revealing himself to his people, he cries out, as John read earlier, at a very large feast, if anyone thirst, let him come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, out of his heart will flow rivers of living water. Of course, Jesus did not say that in a vacuum, devoid of context. He said this to a people who were grumbling against God, against a people who grumbled against the man God himself sent to save them. In the Exodus, God satisfies his physically thirsty people with water. In the greater Exodus, Jesus offers to satisfy his spiritually thirsty people with water. We made clear is the Holy Spirit. But the problem is, there is no problem to admit that you're physically thirsty. It's not so easy to admit you are spiritually thirsty. And even when you know that you're thirsty, naturally you and I have the wrong expectations for what can satisfy us. We naturally think somehow we can satisfy our own thirst. But if you're honest, whatever it is that you run to, you find that you have to keep running back because you're still thirsty. And Jesus is saying to the world, if you're thirsty, come to me, drink, come to me, believe. Why believe in him? Because very uniquely, as the one righteous man, by his life, by his sacrificial death on the cross, by his resurrection, he's shown publicly to the world, he's qualified to save and to satisfy people who before God need salvation. He can satisfy your thirst. So how does God respond to a world that rebels against him, that decides it knows better than him, that decides we will put God on trial? Well, he responds so unexpectedly. He sends his son into this world who, by his life and his death and his resurrection, satisfies thirsty people with living water. Just as Moses struck the rock, the water flowed out. The Apostle Paul reads this text typologically, meaning that what happened here would become something intensified. It would become something other. And when Paul wrote to the Corinthians, he says the rock was Christ. So when the Jews and the Romans didn't just want to kill Jesus, but actually did kill him, living waters flowed out to the world, smitten and stricken on the cross so that you and I could drink of him and be satisfied. So here is the God who's satisfying his people with water at Mount Horeb. He is going to satisfy again in an infinitely greater way at Mount Calvary. I hope you see the unexpected character and ways and goodness of God. And you believe, you drink by entrusting yourself to him. This place would forever be known by Moses' naming it as Massa and Meribah, a place of testing and quarreling. Of all the things, this one people who had the presence of God in the cloud and the fire, they did not believe God was among them. The psalmist picks up on this event. It became a seminal event in the life of God's people. He picks up on it in Psalm 95, and he says this: today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as at Meribah, as on the day at Massa in the wilderness, when your fathers put me to the test. So in grace, God gives them water. In grace, God warns. Today, by the word being proclaimed, you hear the voice of God. This is never a neutral event. We are either soft and so receive the word of the Lord, or we are hard and we dismiss it. Whatever it takes in your own life, don't be hardened to the word of the Lord. Whatever it takes, it's worth it. This is not a neutral world, and we are not neutral people. I hope you see that God was committed beyond all expectations to showing and actually being with his people. What he does to save them when they really only deserved judgment. In the last week, did you in your own heart put the Lord on trial in some way? Did you question if he is who he says he is? Or did you think thoughts of him that are less than who he is of God? Or in any way, did you doubt the goodness of the Lord? It is astonishing in an unexpected way how good the Lord is to this people. They saw his salvation with their own eyes. He has fed them daily by his hand. They lack nothing. They are being promised everything. But don't you see yourself in this? I do. I see myself thinking of the Lord in ways that are not worthy of who he is as the Lord, but the Lord just keeps doing good. Better to us than we can expect or deserve, because the Lord is better than we could ever imagine. Here the Lord is teaching his people, who must live under his rule, how contrary divine grace is to human expectations. Get this in your head. The Lord does not treat his people as we deserve. Grace is undeserved. They got water. They deserved judgment. Grace is not based on your merit. You're never going to earn it. It's why we need supernatural power to receive grace, to live by grace. Grace runs counter to human expectations. It runs counter to what we naturally think of God. This is great news. The true God, revealed in Jesus Christ, does not treat us as our sin deserves. The people did not deserve this. They didn't deserve this any more than anyone else in the ancient world. But God purposed to magnify his glory by giving grace to this very undeserving people, so that when they looked back to Massa and Meribah, where there was very real testing and very real quarreling, they would remember this is the place where the Lord showed us unfathomable grace. Grace we did not deserve. So who is the Lord? He gives unexpected grace to thirsty rebels. He is himself stricken that his people might be satisfied. Testing and thirsting. Secondly, mediation and memorial. Mediation and memorial. Let's read verses 8 through 16. Then Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim. So Moses said to Joshua, "Choose for us men and go out and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand." So Joshua did as Moses told him, and he fought with Amalek, while Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. Whenever Moses held up his hand, Israel prevailed. Whenever he lowered his hand, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands grew weary. So they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it, while Aaron and Hur held up his hands on one side and the other on the other side. So his hands were steady until the going down of the sun, and Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Write this as a memorial in a book and recite it in the ears of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven." And Moses built an altar and called the name of it, "The Lord is my banner," saying, "A hand upon the throne of the Lord. The Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation." So if there was one thing the Israelites did not lack in the wilderness, it was action. My goodness. They go from this massive water problem, and now they've got a problem with their journey. Amalek, who very possibly, this was a busy trade route and they were seeking to control it. They come and they fight with what were very visibly weak and vulnerable Israelites. They were probably some kind of Bedouin people in the northern Sinai. And here, Joshua is first introduced to us, except he's given no introduction. He was known to his original readers. He was Moses' aide. He's the successor. And I find Moses' instructions surprising. There is no elite fighting force. There's no seasoned military. There's just some men to fight with the Amalekites. Do you remember back at the Red Sea what the Lord told his people? You have only to be silent. Now they must fight. They must fight. But Moses says, tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand. So that reads, if you'll remember, kind of like the plague formulas when Moses would announce the plague tomorrow and the judgment would come through his staff. Here, Joshua takes the lead in fighting while Moses and Aaron and Hur are above them. And of course, Hur is not introduced either. I think he too was known to the original readers. He is a descendant of Judah. But what this brief account is focused on is on Moses' hands. They're either held up or they're lowered. Israel prevails when they're held up. The Amalekites prevail when they are lowered. Whether Moses' hands held up should be understood as Moses interceding with Yahweh for his people. This was the posture of prayer, outstretched hands to intercede with God. Or whether the point is that his raised hands demonstrate God is working through his staff, it's clear the Lord is working to save his people through the mediation of Moses. So with hands raised up, Moses' mediation secures the victory for this people. Here, we have a problem with the Amalekites, and the Lord provided. Joshua overwhelmed Amalek. But did you notice something very surprising in this account? Here's a battle with well-armed Amalekites and the very weak, vulnerable Hebrew people. They prevail. And we get nothing about the action of the battle itself, the ups and the downs of it. Why? Because the ultimate battle was not taking place on the battlefield. The real battle, the ultimate battle, was fought by Moses' mediation above. The hope of God's people in that wilderness on that day was the mercy of God and the mediation of Moses. What would God's people have been without Moses, their mediator? What would we be without Jesus, our mediator? The Lord means to set his people's expectations in this way. He goes before us and he comes behind us. And he protects his people from the very unexpected. So in our own wilderness journey in this world, we live in the midst of a great spiritual battle, confident that there is one greater than Moses who ever lives to mediate, to intercede for us. Why do we have confidence that the gospel will go forward and progress? Because in the gospel, our triune God purposed and planned that God the Son would become the God-man and he would be qualified to be the Son of God in power who would ascend into heaven and mediate for his weak people. Before the throne of God above, we have a strong and perfect plea. In Christ, if we could see reality as it really is, we are more protected than we can fathom. The progress of the gospel on earth continues because of Christ's mediation in heaven. The progress of your fight of faith and your fight against sin, although it seems terribly slow, is because of the present session and mediation of Jesus in heaven. The good news of the gospel is in Christ, you are in covenant relationship with the triune God. And it's also good news because it means that Jesus Christ is seated mediating for you in heaven. So just like the Hebrew men on that battlefield, so we also have no hope in the battle of the Christian life apart from Christ's mediation in heaven. So this doctrine, this truth of the present session and intercession of Christ means, well, practically, for some of you, you should know you don't have to pray through saints to God. because of Jesus, the Savior, who lacks nothing. He has no weakness. Did you notice that as Moses' hands were highlighted here, his hands are held up and they're lowered. His hands are wearied until Aaron and Hur help him. In this account, the people are saved by his hands, but Moses' hands grew weak and needed assistance. We have read repeatedly in the book of Exodus that God's people were saved by the hand of the Lord, and it has never been weary. He has never needed help to deliver by his hand. So if you're trusting Christ to save you, think great thoughts of the mediation of Christ. Expect much because of the mediation of Christ. This is mediation that is effective because it's backed by the cross and the resurrection. This is mediation that gives you confidence to live before God and to pray to God, to know joy in God. John Bunyan, centuries ago, reflected on what this means, and he wrote this: "Let this doctrine give you boldness to come to God. Is Jesus Christ interceding in heaven? Oh, then be a praying man on earth. Take courage to pray. Think this: I go to God, before whose throne the Lord Jesus is ready to hand my petitions to him. Yes, he ever lives to make intercession for me." So the problem of the Amalekites is met with the provision of a mediator. The Lord provided beyond what they saw and what they expected. And once again, the Lord means for his people to remember. Verses 14 to 16. For the very first time, Moses is commanded to write this down as a memorial in a book. So the Lord expected Moses to be taking notes and for Joshua to hear it. They were to remember the Lord's provision, but the Amalekites would not be remembered. They would be blotted out. War would be made with them from generation to generation, war that Joshua himself would have to lead and fight. The Lord means for those who oppose him to expect his judgment. His judgment on his terms, in his way. It's a sobering reality that the Lord sets the expectations of for the world again and again. But for God's people, when they leave that place, it's called "The Lord is my banner." That's what the altar was called. To be their banner was to be their standard. They were to look, hope in the Lord, not themselves. They were to come to Sinai, hoping in the Lord. They were to remember how the Lord acted unexpectedly again and again, and so were to be more and more prepared for faithful living in the presence of the Lord in the promised land. Remember the Lord, your mediator, who does better for you than you could deserve or expect. Mediation and memorial. And we finish as we make our way to Sinai in chapter 18, where we see conversion and counsel. Conversion and counsel. Let me read this chapter. Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard of all that God had done for Moses and for Israel, his people, how the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. Now Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, had taken Zipporah, Moses' wife, after he had sent her home, along with her two sons. The name of the one was Gershom, for he said, "I have been a sojourner in a foreign land." And the name of the other, Eleazar, for he said, "The God of my father was my help and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh." Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came with his sons and his wife to Moses in the wilderness where he was encamped at the mountain of God. And when he sent word to Moses, "I, your father-in-law, Jethro, am coming to you with your wife and her two sons with her," Moses went out to meet his father-in-law and bowed down and kissed him. And they asked each other of their welfare and went into the tent. Then Moses told his father-in-law all that the Lord had done to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, all the hardship that had come upon them in the way, and how the Lord had delivered them. And Jethro rejoiced for all the good that the Lord had done to Israel, in that he had delivered them out of the hand of the Egyptians. Jethro said, "Blessed be the Lord, who has delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of Pharaoh, and has delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians." Now I know that the Lord is greater than all gods, because in this affair they dealt arrogantly with the people. And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, brought a burnt offering and sacrifices to God. And Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law before God. The next day, Moses set to judge the people, and the people stood around Moses from morning till evening. When Moses' father-in-law saw all that he was doing for the people, he said, "What is this that you are doing for the people? Why do you sit alone, and all the people stand around you from morning till evening?" And Moses said to his father-in-law, "Because the people come to inquire to inquire of God. When they have a dispute, they come to me, and I decide between one person and another. And I make them known the statutes of God and his laws." Moses' father-in-law said to him, "What you are doing is not good. You and the people with you will certainly wear yourselves out, for the thing is too heavy for you. You are not able to do it all alone. Now obey my voice. I will give you advice, and God be with you. You shall represent the people before God and bring their cases to God, and you shall warn them about the statutes and the laws and make them know the way in which they must walk and what they must do. Moreover, look for able men from all the people, men who fear God, who are trustworthy and hate a bribe, and place such men over the people as chiefs of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, and of tens. And let them judge the people at all times. Every great matter they shall bring to you, but any small matter they shall decide themselves. So it will be easier for you, and they will bear the burden with you. If you do this, God will direct you. You will be able to endure, and all this people also will go to their place in peace." So Moses listened to the voice of his father-in-law and did all that he had said. Moses chose able men out of all Israel and made them heads over the peoples, chiefs of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, and of tens, and they judged the people at all times. Any hard case they brought to Moses, but any small matter they decided themselves. Then Moses let his father-in-law depart, and he went away to his own country. So we have these dramatic accounts in which the Lord gives water, and he defeats the Amalekites, and to me, very surprisingly, those dramatic accounts are given 16 verses. But this account of Jethro and the reunion gets 27. So why is this? Well, first, Jethro is the priest of Midian. He has leadership among a foreign people. And you probably noticed again and again and again, he is called Moses' father-in-law. So the relational peace between Moses and his father-in-law, Zipporah, who did not go with Moses to Egypt, and their sons, comes to him as well. And we get the meaning of the name of Moses' sons, like Massa and Meribah. They reflect the circumstances of Moses' life. When they were named, they would always remind Moses that he was a sojourner who is where he is by the help of God. But now we're coming full circle in Moses' life since he left his home in Midian. That's what the reunion of Jethro represents. The Lord has been with you, Moses, as you come to Mount Sinai. And especially notice this. Just as the Amalekites came and fought with Israel at the end of chapter 17, so they were judged, Jethro too comes, verse 5. And verse 9, he rejoices in the good that the Lord has done. And verse 10, he doesn't fight with Moses or the people, but he blesses the Lord. And he says in verse 11, what has been the entire goal of the Exodus. "Now I know that the Lord is greater than all gods." So in verse 1, Jethro heard this. So probably through trade and travel, word had gotten out. And as he heard the details of what Yahweh had done, he comes to confident praise to him. He offers a burnt offering in verse 12, sacrifices. He enjoys a fellowship meal with Moses and Aaron and the elders. The only reason this reunion happens is because the Lord is greater than all the gods. By the Lord's power, Moses had confronted the world's superpower, delivered a multitude of slaves. So from Midian in Exodus 3 now to Horeb in Exodus 18, the Lord has provided. And here is Jethro. He's not even seen these events with his own eyes. He's only heard about them coming in belief in Yahweh, the Lord. So I know some of you thought about this and asked about this, but I think the text shows us Jethro is a convert from the false gods to the true God. Based on what he heard, he exalts in Yahweh. He believes in him. And it's a glimpse of what was coming. Foreigners would hear of Yahweh's great salvation and rejoice in him. You know this in the Exodus account. There has been again and again hardness. That's what we've come to expect, even among Israel. But here, unexpectedly, is a foreigner who sees the supremacy of Yahweh and believes him. This is conversion. And its evidence is sound trust in the Lord. Trust that is demonstrated through very real transformation. Conversion means that what you ultimately praise and treasure changes. It changes what and who has authority in your life. It changes what you love and who you love. Jethro comes to and under the authority of Yahweh the Lord. And I think that Yahweh the Lord means for his people to expect that there are more Jethros who will be coming. And then from verses 13 to 27, this convert gives good counsel to Moses. I can't imagine the workload that Moses had, the burdens he carried every day, too heavy for Moses, not to be done alone. So Jethro's counsel in verse 21 is to find some able men. They need to fear God, and they don't take bribes. Moses, you take the greater matters, they take the lesser matters. Very practically, how critical godly men will be to the future of this people. Men who deny themselves because they delight in God. Men who don't fear men they see because they fear the God they do not see. It's the kind of men we need. The kind of men that we want young men and teenagers to aspire to be in this wicked world. Church needs such men. The world is desperate for such men. Men who have strength, but they use that strength to care for the weak rather than to exploit the weak or manipulate the weak. Men who are walking in a very wicked world with wisdom and not folly and arrogance. Men who are seeking relationships not to get stuff, but to give away. Jethro says, Moses, basically, find some godly men. And that was counsel wise enough for the many problems. And notice that the Lord's provision is also seen in this fact. There were actually men who met those qualifications. Verse 25, Moses chose able men, and he made them the heads of various numbers of people. Each one mattered, each stewardship authority mattered. The Lord knew them. He cares. Do you see that as this people now come to Mount Sinai, they are a people forged and formed by the Lord. He's giving them everything they need, not just to be a people, but to continue to live as a people. He's provided their water. He's provided their mediation. He raised up a convert. He's given them wise counsel. They are a people who come to Mount Sinai who should know now that our God is not like you would expect him to be. The more we come to know him, the better we see that he is. Our God gives uniquely water to thirsty rebels. He gives victory to the weak and the vulnerable. He gives bread to people that grumble against him. And he is exalted in and praised by the most surprising converts. Oh, and also our God in the cloud and the fire, he's given his presence to his people. But of course, more is coming, in a way that will upend the expectations of the world and heaven itself. The Lord will give his presence to his people in the baby born in the manger. The Lord, Yahweh, was with his people until he became one of his people. As we go away from this text, let the Lord upend your life. Let him change your expectations Let him renew them and give you greater expectations. Here is the Lord, our hope, our provider. He gives us more than we could ever expect, certainly more than we could ever deserve. Here is the Lord who can hold forever the hopes of each one of his people.